And you know, we're not just selling into like software companies, right? We actually do the hard work. We're working with the physical world, right? Companies that build chips, companies that build, you know, planes and cars and industrial equipment and drugs and so on and so forth. So these are not companies that are easy to please in some sense, because you know, these are safety critical products at the end of the day. And we work with very conservative engineers and scientists, but we've been at this for a very long time. We've, you know, got tremendous amount of mindshare and respect from, you know, from some of these key technical decision makers at some of the world's, you know, largest companies. And that is what is sort of, you know, leading to this the proverbial hockey stick for the next year.
Hi, wherever you're listening to this, I hope you're doing well. Welcome to Startup Fridays, conversations with accomplished entrepreneurs and VC investors. I'm Hari Arakli, and in today's episode, Dr. Viral Shah, co-founder of Julia Hub, an enterprise software startup that offers products around the Julia programming language, of which he is also one of the inventors, talks about this new scientific programming language's journey that will touch 15 years in the new year that's coming, while its first public release was in 2012. Julia Language is an open source project that originated at MIT, and it has been downloaded tens of millions of times, and thousands of companies use it for its technical computing and machine learning features. At Julia Hub, which was founded in 2015, with customers including some of the world's biggest companies in pharmaceuticals, aerospace, semiconductors, and industrial engineering, and about $43 million in funding, Viral and his co-founders dream of helping scientists and engineers innovate faster by offering a way out of what he calls the two-language problem. Viral, welcome to this podcast, and thank you so much for making time for us very generously. And just to give a more general audience a sense of what you do and how you got interested in tech. Of course, within the world of scientific computing, your work is very well known. Julia Hub also is now quite well known. You have many well-known enterprise customers. And I know that in the broader sort of Indian landscape, your work with Nandan Nilekani is also well recognized. You co-authored a book with him.
Yep.
But let's talk about Julia Hub. Give us sort of a brief background about what the company is about, and also a little bit of background about yourself, how you got to start this company and so on. Go from there.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know, this has been a very long journey, right? I started my work on Julia in almost 2009. And, you know, since you mentioned Nandan Nilekani and our book, you know, I should say that I started both my work on Aadhaar and on Julia in the same week, in fact. Uh-huh. When I had, you know, finished my PhD at UC Santa Barbara, come back to India, met Nandan, started the work on Aadhaar, and then simultaneously I was, you know, also exchanging emails with you know, three of my other co-founders, Alan Edelman at MIT and Jeff Bezanson and Stefan Karpinski, and we were bouncing this idea about around about, you know, hey, the world probably needs a new programming language because we are tired of languages like, you know, back in that day, everyone used to use MATLAB, and they still do, but it was a lot bigger back then. And we just said, you know, the world needs something better. And that's how we came about with, you know, our work on Julia. if you don't mind sort of a little bit of dive into different kinds of languages, what I'll say is that there are broadly two types of languages. There are languages that are used by researchers like MATLAB or Python or R, you know, that are easy to work with and they're interactive, but they often are not fast enough. And then there are languages that people use for deployment and for building large scale applications like C or C++ or Java or, you know, Rust increasingly now. And sometimes people call these things as system languages. And you always had to pick one or the other. You had to either pick the ease of use or you had to pick, you know, performance and deployment. Mm. And people always thought that this was almost like a, you know, like a law of physics, that you can either have one or the other. And Julia was the first language that actually said, no, you can have the ease of use of some of these scripting languages, but also have the performance of these systems languages. And that's how, you know, we started our work on Julia, because the world kept telling us that this is not possible. And we said, you know what, like we actually want to go ahead and you know, build this out and see where it goes.
Yeah. I was listening to, I mean, by way of some homework, some of your earlier interviews and so on, trying to understand your work a little bit to the extent that I could. And I came across this particular point where you spoke about how when you started, or even through your PhD work, something of a frustration with the way what you called numerical computing
yes.
was happening. Can you give us a layman's sense of yeah. what the significance was back then?
Yes, and this, you know, so, you know, when numerical computing is, you know, broadly, you know, what, you know, computers are very good at crunching numbers, right? And a lot of the technical applications, you know, so if you think of like all the different kinds of applications that people build, right? You know, you people build smartphone applications, they build websites, web development, you know, they build AI applications and you know, they build scientific applications. In fact, if you, you know, trace through the history of computing, computers were used for, you know, some of the first applications that computers were built for were actually scientific in nature, right? You know, for example, calculating ballistics of projectiles, you know, in the Navy. And you know, so if I fire a projectile over a long distance, what are all the different forces that act upon it and where will it land, right? These were some of the first uses that computers were put to. Or, you know, and then like, you know, in astronomy, right, like figuring out, you know, the tidal patterns and all these things. And so a lot of the real world tends to be, you know, physical, right? And you're modeling physics or chemistry or some kind of, you know, mathematical concept. And so mathematical computing, often called numerical computing, often now popularized through machine learning, you know, is essentially sort of, people doing lots, you know, millions, well, I guess not millions, but trillions of floating point operations in order to either predict a physical phenomena or, you know, or use ChatGPT to predict, you know, the next word, you know, in the response that you get from the bots. And that's what sort of this entire field is about, right? So Julia focuses a lot on technical computing, you know, which, you know, which is, you know, which could be numerical, scientific, AI, machine learning, what, you know, call it whatever name you want. And that's what we focus on. And this is sort of the frustration that I was talking about, right? That, so we came up with this phrase, it's called solving the two language problem. So often you had to sort of prototype your ideas in an easy language and then rewrite them in a different language. So you prototype it in, say, MATLAB or Python, you would rewrite it in C to get performance. And that just, you know, if you think about it, right, it's wasted effort, like writing the same program twice. So if you could empower scientists, engineers, you know, physicists or you know, quantitative analysts or actuaries or people who actually work, you know, with applied mathematical ideas, if you empower them with a programming language and tools so that not only can they think of the next, you know, innovation, but also then convert that idea into practice without having to involve a large programming team to transfer their ideas. Like, that's a very powerful thing. And that's what sort of accelerates the pace of innovation, right? So, you know, if I'm designing a new battery, if I'm designing a new rocket, rocket engine, if I'm designing, you know, the next self-driving car, you know, empowering the engineers themselves, right, who are building the physical hardware, to also be able to, you know, write the software that will control it, is, you know, is sort of like game changing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I bring you back to what you said. Julia combines the ease of use and the performance. Again, without getting very technical about it, can you give us a sense of what was the approach you all took to achieve this? And maybe, even if it's a bit technical, give us a sense of what was the innovation that through which you achieved it?
Yeah, that's so let me first start out with a non-technical answer. Right? So people always ask us, like, hey, if this thing was impossible, you know, how did you go about doing it, right? And I always say, you know, think about how you make a fast performance car, right? You know, if you want to build a car like a Ferrari or something, right, that is insanely fast. So, you know, you don't start with a Tata Indica, right? And then, add a jet engine to it. Or, you can't start out with something that was designed for a specific purpose and then kind of, you know, change the engine, change the fuel, maybe throw out some parts. And, you know, I'm not trying to pick on Indica. I think it's a fantastic product, but for what it was designed. But if you wanted a Ferrari, if you wanted a high-performance race car, then you start from the ground up with a design, right? That is meant to achieve that. And that is what we did with Julia. So instead of taking something that already existed, we said, let's start from the ground up and build something that, you know, actually is designed to achieve productivity and performance. And so we came up with a lot of new ideas. In fact, Julia is one of the first languages to incorporate this idea of multiple dispatch, in a large scale programming language. And it's if you think about, you know, the way to understand it, it's a generalization of object oriented programming. So, you know, people used to do procedural programming, they did functional programming, object oriented programming, and Julia took some of these ideas and then came up. You know, we didn't invent multiple dispatch, it was always known, but we are I'd like to think that we made it mainstream in a language that is used by over a million people around the world today. And so that was very powerful. And, as we sort of built out the language, it turned out that some of the core ideas of multiple dispatch and using tools like LLVM for code generation and generic programming, and, I'm throwing a few words here, But if taking some of these ideas that had existed before and putting them in a package in a way that nobody else had, we were able to build something that was just very easy to work with, but also tremendously fast.
Explain the significance of what you call multiple dispatch in sort of layman's terms. I think that will give people an idea of
a feel for let me take a very, very simple example, right? So one of the things you do with computers is arithmetic, right? So let's say that we are going to do, 1 + 1. And now, you might add two integers, right? Just 1 and 1, 1 + 1 gives 2. But you might also add an integer with a floating point value, like 1 + 2.5, which will give you 3.5. Now these are two different, right? The first one was adding two integers. The next one was adding an integer with, what you might often call a decimal value, or in computer science, we call a floating point value. And mathematically, you'd say, what's the big deal, right? It's adding two numbers, and we know how to do that. But when it comes to, computers, are not that abstract, right? They operate with very, very specific information. And the way your CPU that is in your laptop or your desktop, right, adds two integer numbers is very different from the way it would add two floating point values. And one of the things that Julia, does a very good job at is that when you write your program, it will analyze it automatically and figure out all the different types of, hey, this one is an integer, this one is a floating point value, this one is a string. And, it will generate highly efficient machine code for the specific operation that you're doing. So if it sees two integers, it'll emit a certain kind of instruction. If it sees that you're doing floating point operations, it'll emit different kinds of instructions. And it kind of takes a lot of the boilerplate out and just kind of, goes down into the core and just generates the minimum specific optimal, machine code to do what you asked it to do.
Okay, let's jump to Julia Hub. I mean, from 2009, I think, next year, the whole journey is going to be 15 years.
Yeah.
Along the way now, in more recent years, you all have built a company, you raised some funding. And while the main software remains purely open source,
yes,
but you have now built some very strong products for enterprise customers.
Yes.
So tell us more about Julia Hub.
So, you know, Julia Hub is, you know, it's a company that was created by the founders and many of the core contributors of Julia who kind of came together. We initially was created by the four of us who created Julia itself. But, you know, now we are about 100 people. The company was formed in 2015. And, you know, our mission was basically to make, you know, make it possible for everyone else to benefit from the superpowers that Julia has. Now, Julia itself is open source. Like I said, it's a million users around the world, taught at, you know, MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, all these, you know, top universities. And it's just tremendous, you know, what the Julia community has achieved. We have 10,000 open source packages in the Julia ecosystem on top of just the language itself. So the company, you know, what happened was in the very early days, our customers started reaching out to us and saying, hey, the open source stuff is, you know, is awesome, but to bring it inside the enterprise, you know, we need security, we need, we need support, we need training, we need, like we can't access the internet, many of the companies said, for our, some of our most, you know, crucial projects that they have to be done in-house on-prem. And then there were other companies who are like, oh, we need to do everything on the cloud. So the question is, how can you provide a set of, you know, how can you make Julia easy to use within enterprises? And we built Julia Hub as a cloud platform in order to facilitate that. So for example, you know, some of the largest semiconductor companies worldwide are using Julia Hub in order to develop, you know, the fastest chips, you know, that are in all the products that you use on a day-to-day basis. There are companies that are, you know, using Julia for, you know, in aerospace applications, right? Like there are companies, the Moderna vaccine, for example, you know, the certification, the FDA certification for that, leveraged, you know, a Julia-based product called Pumas. So companies around the world, you know, large and small, are using Julia to do cutting-edge things, right? That they're, you know, shaving off months and, you know, weeks and months and years from product design. And in order to accelerate their workload, their workflow, you know, we designed Julia Hub, which is a cloud platform, also runs on-premise, in order to make it very easy for Julia developers, you know, to...
Is a company called Julia Computing and the cloud platform is Julia?
Well, it's a very good question. So the company used to be, when we started, it was called Julia Computing,
right.
But we just renamed it to Julia Hub so that, you know, we just have fewer terms in the mix. Now, one of the very interesting things about, you know, Julia Hub as a company is that, you know, yes, so we built Julia Hub as a cloud product, which makes it very easy to, you know, for developers in companies to work with Julia. But those same customers, you know, as we sort of kept talking to them, they said, you know, hey, Julia has these amazing superpowers, but if you can build modeling and simulation products on top of it, then it would become even easier for engineers and scientists and specialists at these companies to adopt these new technologies. So, you know, what we learned from our customers was that, hey, if we use the superpowers of Julia ourselves and design some of these, you know, modern modeling and simulation products, it will actually be a game changer. And that's how, you know, we started our journey of creating three scientific machine learning products. And if you don't mind, I'll kind of like jump into like explaining a few of them. So we started, you know, the first one that we built was a product called Pumas in partnership with a company called Pumas AI. And, you know, it stands for pharmaceutical modeling and simulation. And Pumas is what, you know, has been used for making, you know, over 50 FDA submissions today by pharmaceutical companies around the world. Mm. And it's a tremendously successful pharmaceutical software that is used by pharmacometricians in all the big companies around the world. The second product that we built, you know, ourselves, it's a product called Julia Sim, and Julia Sim is actually used for engineering design. So, you know, if I'm an aerospace company, if I'm an automotive company, if I'm a manufacturer, you know, if I'm doing, you know, industrial automation, all of these applications you know, they require design, they require software to be, you know, working on actual hardware, software that, you know, flies the plane, software that runs, you know, flies the satellite, software that runs the many of the systems in a car. And Julia Sim is a, you know, is a modeling and simulation platform that makes it possible to go all the way from design to deployment to digital twins on the cloud, right? So think of sort of the entire workflow of industrial companies. It just makes it tremendously more powerful. In fact, you know, we use the phrase programming the physical world. That's what Julia Sim is. It's, you know, it's the tool that you use to program the entire physical world. And we think this is going to be a game changer for in the world of engineering. And the third one, so that we built, is a tool called Cedar, and that is for electronic design automation. It's an EDA software, and Cedar is used for designing chips. It's analog design.
Can you talk about the business model a little bit more? You've offered products and some consultancy and services.
Yes.
Top of the open source software. So you said you have now put it all on cloud.
Yes.
So is the business model like that of a SaaS company? And I would imagine with some mission critical projects and where there must be a lot of intellectual property involved as well.
Yes.
Some of that might be on premises.
Yes.
So just give us a sense of your business model.
Yeah. So, you know, broadly speaking, like I said, Julia Hub, you know, is a platform to make it easy to work with Julia applications. You know, either if you write your own or use one of the products that we provide. And Julia Hub runs on the cloud, but it also runs on-premise. So, you know, we don't want to force customers one way or the other. In fact, if you sort of reflect back on some of the conversation that we're having, right, like the companies who are using Julia and some of our simulation products like Julia Sim and Cedar and Pumas, these applications are at the core of the company's crown jewels, right? They're not, you know, it's not like, say, for example, an HR software or, a general purpose kind of software that every company uses. It's not like a database, for example, right? It is the core of, you know, what these companies use for designing their products. It's, you know, core to their existence in some sense. And as a result, many of them often want to keep that IP safeguarded and on-premise. Mm-hmm. And while cloud is getting significantly more secure and you know, IT departments at companies are increasingly becoming comfortable with the idea of running more applications on the cloud, we have a long way to go. And a lot of government applications as well, which all run on-premise.
Mm-hmm. So one gets the sense that you're now at a point where you're looking at the proverbial hockey stick growth.
Yes.
Of a startup's journey. If not that, I mean, in the current sort of slowdown environment and all that, even that taken into account, one gets the sense that you're now looking at a significant acceleration of your commercialization part of the journey.
Yes.
Can you talk about that opportunity from here onwards? What are some of the most important opportunities you want to capture?
Yeah. So, commercialization, we've been through three phases in our company. With commercialization, like you mentioned, we started with open source and consulting originally. And, that was step one. Then step two, we built Julia Hub as a cloud platform to make it easy for people to, you know, use Julia at work. And then step three, we built a suite of modeling and simulation applications. And what has happened at each stage is that our products become more and more useful to the companies, and that more and more of their core product design work and product deployment work is being done in our systems. And as a result, as a result of that, these products are also allow us to capture a larger value of the customer's IT or, you know, programming spend in some sense. And that is what is sort of driving a lot of the acceleration, is that not only are we going to our customers and saying, hey, learn Julia and build out these applications over the next several years, and then, you know, you'll see these tremendous benefits. We are saying, hey, we have products ready to go, and, you know, it will change your workflow and bring you tremendous productivity and performance benefits right away. And that message is resonating with all of, like, several of the large Fortune 500 companies. And, you know, we're not just selling into, like, software companies, right? You know, we actually do the hard work. We're working with the physical world, right? Companies that build chips, companies that build, you know, planes and cars and industrial equipment and drugs and so on and so forth. So these are, you know, these are not companies that are easy to please in some sense, because, you know, these are safety critical products at the end of the day. And we work with very conservative engineers and scientists, but we've been at this for a very long time. We've, you know, got tremendous amount of mind share and respect from, you know, from some of these key technical decision makers at some of the world's, you know, largest companies. And that is what is sort of, you know, leading to this the proverbial hockey stick for the next year.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, about 6 months ago, you raised another round of funding.
Yes.
Overall, you're not too far from $50 million in funding.
Yes.
And in that sense, and also the latest round, I was speaking with, as you know, Deepak back in July. I got to learn about how an important aerospace-focused firm is now a backer of
yes.
Julia. So all of that put together, of course, your focus would still be on the US and Europe, those kinds of advanced sort of mature markets. But can you also talk about, I mean, in the coming years, what you see happening in India and whether, and also I ask this because, as you know, in recent years, there's much more awareness and interest in India in the overall broader deep tech umbrella kind of you know, landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those emerging startups would probably be your customers.
Yes.
So can you give us a sense of how India is shaping up for you as a market?
So India is, so you're absolutely right that US and Europe are sort of the mature markets. But I was looking at some of the data, and 10% of the global modeling and simulation software spend is actually out of India.
Okay.
That is tremendous. Like, I don't think in many industries, for example, I when I worked on Aadhaar, I worked a lot on payments, and all the payment companies would say, oh, India is like, you know, less than 1% of our global revenue. But in modeling and simulation, the number is 10%. And a lot of it is, of course, you know, product design that happens locally, right? Like, your Tatas, Mahindras, and so on, who are actually, you know, designing and building cars from scratch in India, and also have operations overseas. You know, we have our own, aerospace industry, domestic, but also increasingly startups that are now selling abroad as well. We have, you know, a large manufacturing base, and, you know, of course, in India, there is this focus on Make in India to bring even more manufacturing. There is an, you know, ongoing emphasis on local chip design. And so there is this tremendous movement towards building more products out of India itself. But also, you know, we are service providers to a large part of the world, a lot of engineering design, right? Like Intel, for example, has a large chip development center right here in Bangalore. So does AMD, so does NVIDIA, right? And so does Boeing and GE pick any name, right? So as service providers, you know, to the rest of the world, but also as product designers locally, India has come a long way, and having sort of some of these technologies, you know, being developed and built right here out of Bangalore, I think it's a pretty proud moment for all of us.
Mm. So yeah, I would imagine all the what people call global capability centers in the industry, many of those would already be experimenting with Julia, and probably also using commercial versions and so on. So on the point of Make in India, one thing that I always want to learn more about, whenever I get a chance to speak with someone like you who's straddling both the science and the business side of things,
right?
Especially in the US, but also deeply connected mm-hmm. to the ecosystem in India. In the context of Make in India, and while generally everyone talks about how India is a software powerhouse and so on, if you look at a programming language like Julia, for example. And first of all, and I've heard you and others talk about how that itself is a, you know, sort of basically you get into it thinking that you're going to fail, because from what I understand from your previous comments is that a programming language becoming successful is pretty rare and takes a decade and so on. So that's one thing. And then there's this whole sort of generative AI revolution that's happened and large language models. What I'm sort of aiming at is, if you take these kinds of software, which are very fundamental, really inventive, one doesn't seem to find a lot of that happening in India yet. I'm just wondering if you have any views on that.
It is true that, you know, for example, if you look at this, the space of LLMs, right, like a lot of the work was done at Google and OpenAI and Meta out of, you know, actually Silicon Valley, not even other parts of the US. And very broadly speaking, I'm over generalizing here. But definitely not out of India, right? Now there are, you know, some tremendous startups that have been formed in India that are going to sort of build on top of these LLM technologies. And maybe even make fundamental improvements to those models. But you're right that, you know, that innovation did not come out of India. And I think we have a long way to go. I mean, I don't think, LLMs aside, right, let's say, you know, looking at some of the work that we've done with Julia, right, like I created, you know, at least all my contributions on Julia have been out of Bangalore initially, like for the first 10 years of our existence. And, you know, we have a fantastic team in Bangalore. We have a fantastic set of students that have, you know, worked with us over the years. And Julia is one of those, you know, crucial technologies which has a significant contribution from India. Not just a sort of add-on contribution, but a core contribution. So I think it's definitely possible. And but it's we just need more of it, right? We just need more of an ecosystem, you know, more venture funding, more startup funding, more risk taking, better education in our colleges. You know, like everything's available on the internet now, right? So I would just think it's a journey, and you know, like all of what we're speaking now, none of it existed 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we were always sort of seen as the service providers to the rest of the world. Whether it was in engineering services or whether it was software design or Y2K or whatnot. And today, I mean, we have a tremendous product portfolio that is built in India. And going forward, I would only imagine that we'll get better at it. And I think LLMs are just one thing. I think they're on everyone's minds today. It is kind of fascinating to type stuff into ChatGPT and, you know, have it, you know, give you answers, hallucinated or otherwise, you know, but everyone's using them today, right? And everyone's kind of figuring out where those boundaries are. But I think it's a question we should ask ourselves in India that, you know, hey, what could we have done, right? Like, you know, why did it not happen out of India?
But do you see, even if it's sort of very nascent, do you see that transition happening in India where people like you and other scientists, and what I said holds true for other areas as well, right? Whether it is basic research in drug development or battery chemistry or as a cell chemistry, take any area, right. I think, anecdotally, I know that there are startups who are now trying to do all of this out of India. I'm just wondering if you see this transition happening where...
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely, the transition is happening and it won't happen overnight, right? Because if you think about, like, if you're a cell designer, if you're making a new battery chemistry or a new kind of cell, finally you need an ecosystem in which you would sell that into, right? And the Indian ecosystem is not as big as, you know, what you have in the US and Europe today, right? So it's interlinked, right? It finally boils down to, you know, as India, what's our GDP? What's our GDP growth? Where is it coming from? And the strength of the local economy and the strength of our products in the global world, right? We all know that we have tremendous human potential. We have, you know, one of the highest numbers of engineers who are being trained across the world, you know, and that has powered our services industry. But we need to go up the value chain, just like, you know, with at Julia Hub, right? We started out with open source and consulting, and then we built a crowd product. Now we're building, you know, modeling and simulation products, right? So we are getting closer and closer to that product design as a company. As a country, you got to do exactly the same thing, right? We used to be an agro-powered economy, became a services-powered economy. You're increasingly, you know, becoming a product-powered economy. And, you know, as that economy grows, you know, instead of two car manufacturers, like maybe, you know, if you have 10, then people designing batteries, you know, will be able to sort of find more capital, find more talent, find more customers, and make it all work. And you know, you're seeing the same with, you know, with our aerospace industry, right? It used to be all government led and government run, and now you know, there's a tremendous expansion in the private sector. I think it's on the right path, but as policymakers, you know, if we were policymakers, the question we should ask is, what can we do to accelerate it? And you know, there you can always do things. You can always make things better, right?
Mm-hmm. For you at Julia Hub, the company, what would you say at this juncture are your top challenges?
Top challenges at Julia. So, you know, the challenges for something. So what we build, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if I talk about these modeling and simulation products, right? Like our customers are using these products, you know, as sort of a core part of their own product design, right? And because a lot of these applications are safety critical, there is a lot of resistance to change. So it is, you know, it's the exact opposite of ChatGPT, our business, right? ChatGPT burst out onto the scene day one. It's hallucinating. It's providing wrong answers. But hey, it's not safety critical, right? You're chatting with it. You know, you can kind of look at its responses and decide for yourself, like, you know, hey, does this make sense? Maybe it doesn't. Let me follow up. Let me research a little bit more, right? But at the end of the day, it's like the perfect hockey stick product, right? Like, I don't know how many products have seen faster adoption than ChatGPT today. But that's not how you design an aircraft, right? That's not how you design a nuclear reactor. That's not how you design a new drug. And these things are hard in the physical world. I mean, and, you know, writing software that core, you know, doing sort of hardware software co-design, that's the phrase that we use, right? When you program the physical world, that stuff is just hard. And for us, it gives us purpose. Like, we are doing things that nobody else is doing. Our customers are naturally risk averse and conservative, but the payoff is high at the end of the day in terms of your contribution to society upon, you know, the impact that you made. Not very many people are doing what we are doing. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't do this, nobody else would. So, you know, we think of ourselves as solving an important problem, and, you know, we'll build a successful company while we are at it. But it's just, you know, it's going to take time.
Briefly give us a sense of sort of the scale and scope of Julia Hub today. How many developers worldwide does it touch on a daily basis in some way?
So, you know, it's, you know, Julia, like I said, Julia is used by over 1 million developers worldwide. There's, you know, 10,000 open source packages that are out there. So it's, we've seen downloads from over 10,000 companies and over 2,000 universities around the world. And this data is actually old. So I would think it's at least, you know, quadrupled by now. So this is sort of, I mean, it's staggering the size of the community, and, you know, and it is still nascent, right? Like other ecosystems like Python are 10x, 50x larger, right? But 1 million programmers is kind of like, it's good bragging rights, I would say, right? Like it means that you got enough, of a base that you started with, and that, you know, that's bound to grow. So some of the technologies, like, people often think of, like, hey, how will you overtake Python or MATLAB or whatever, right? Like, the key thing to remember is those tools, those languages and technologies started in the 80s and 90s. You know, Julia is a product of the 2010s. So, you know, if you just kind of, like, map out the rates of adoption, it is far faster than many of those technologies achieved in their first 10 years.
Okay, I have two other discussion points, and then we'll wrap it up. I do want to ask you a little bit about your personal journey as a computer scientist and an entrepreneur.
Okay.
But before that, I wanted to at least touch upon what is today emerging as an important debate around AI, which is, you know, there is the whole open source movement, and that there's the proprietary AI development from big tech companies, and very well-known experts like Professor Andrew Ng have kind of weighed in on one side or the other, or at least offered opinions on, you know, how things are shaping up. While I won't put you in a spot on taking a side, I thought you are well placed to explain what the debate is to a general audience.
Yes. So this debate is not just about AI, right? This debate has always been around, like, proprietary software versus open source software. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's sometimes people kind of get swayed and they want to pick a side that one is naturally superior to the other. But that's not actually the case, right? So, you know, like, let me even, you know, give our own example, right? Like, you know, we built Julia, which is a very large open source project. But, you know, some of our tools like Julia Sim and Cedar and Pumas are actually proprietary. And, you know, because, you know, this has to do with the microstructure of the industries and the nature of the business that you're selling into, right? That if you're, you know, when you're building a large community where you're getting contributions from thousands of people, the incentive for every new contributor to make a small contribution and get something large in return is, you know, is what drives that, right? And that's why Julia can be a successful open source project with thousands of contributors. But if I'm building a specific, you know, tool, a modeling and simulation tool for drug development, that is used by a much smaller community. The users are only at companies and maybe, you know, certain academic institutions, and you would not see contributions coming back. So the economics do not work out and make sense, and it naturally has to be a proprietary tool. The buyers want to buy it from a company, so on and so forth, right? So proprietary and open source both have their own places. So the debate with the with the LLMs is that now, hey, if Microsoft and OpenAI and some of these large Silicon Valley companies, Google maybe, right, like, develop these LLMs, and they're the only ones who have it, then they're going to monopolize it, and everyone else will have to pay rents to these companies in order to access these technologies. And then there is another group of people who believe that, you know, hey, these are fundamental technologies that are of, you know, that have wide usage, and having them as open source is actually good for the creation of an ecosystem where, you know, others can then fine-tune those models and, you know, adapt them to specific domains. So if you don't have open source language models, LLMs, then you might not be able to do that, or you might be held hostage by one of the big tech companies. Maybe, you know, they just don't care about your application. So, you know, you might be sort of not be able to make progress. The other thing is that academic institutions, researchers often need open source code bases, open access, you know, and open data sets in order to do work in a collaborative manner. Time and again, open source communities have shown that collaboration in the wide space of academics and open source hobbyists and even startups and companies can often work together in a loosely coordinated way and produce tremendous outcomes. But it's not necessarily always the winner, right? Like, you can get that, but you can also have something like OpenAI or Google, who has tremendous resources, who can train these models and data sets, you know, spending millions of dollars on a training that open source communities cannot. Where the open source community has shined is bringing these costs down, right? Making the models, you know, getting great results with smaller models, you know, and those might not be the incentives of some of these larger companies, right? So there's a lot going on. There are lots of different explorations that everyone is carrying out, and the world is better off by having more rather than less. You know, whether it's more proprietary models is better than just one or two. You know, a few more open source models, you know, that offer a different color is better than only proprietary models. So, you know, I think this is sort of this is how I think about this.
Okay, as we begin to wrap up, I do want to capture some anecdotes from your own personal journey as a computer scientist and an entrepreneur. You started learning programming pretty early, back in middle school or high school.
Yes.
With BASIC.
Yes.
Can you tell us how you got interested, what happened?
Yeah. So you know, in my school, I went to a school that was back then called Hindi Vidya Bhavan, although it was not a Hindi medium school.
But, where was this?
This was in Mumbai, and in our eighth standard, we had a computer like a computer class, and it was kind of cool and interesting. Like it was the only room that had air conditioning, right, in the whole school, and so you kind of would feel like, oh, I'm entering something futuristic as a little kid, and then you had this computer, and like you know, this like it was with floppy drives, and you had to load the basic interpreter on it, and then you know, run your code, and to me, it was just fascinating, and you know, I probably was one of the few people in our class who actually, you know, figured it. It was one of those things that was not in the board exam. It was not in the 10th standard, so it was a strictly optional subject in that sense. But I just loved it. I just loved programming it, and you know, as I went into high school, I found myself learning physics and chemistry, and then prototyping all those physics and chemistry laws in BASIC, in fact.
What did your parents do back then? When you were in school, what were your parents doing?
My dad ran a small business selling, he was a redistributor for laboratory chemicals. And my mom actually spent all her time raising us, so which is probably why I was able to do what I did.
And I was just trying to. Quite often, when I speak with entrepreneurs, there can be like a seed of an influence going all the way back to childhood, which, looking back, they feel that played a role, if not a strong role, but did play a role in them becoming entrepreneurs. So I'm just, you know. As a journalist, I'm always curious about such things.
I would say that, you know, I actually, now that you ask this is not something I've thought about for a long time, but, you know, because my dad dealt in fact, our whole family is in laboratory chemicals, I had my own chemistry lab at home with all kinds of, you know, rare and esoteric chemicals, and it was just fascinating for me as a kid. And I was always scientifically oriented, but I actually had sort of, you know, access to laboratory equipment that would not otherwise be commonly available.
Did you ever mix up anything that you didn't know was toxic?
I definitely did, but I should not disclose too much.
What is it about programming that fascinates you even today?
You know, this goes back to the first time I wrote a program. It's one of the few things where, if you can dream it up, you can implement it, and it is liberating, right? Like to think about an idea, and you know, programming is one of those few general purpose tools that you can do anything with it, right? We have this concept of, you know, Turing complete languages. Like, hey, this is it's the most expressive thing that you can have, and you can do anything with it. Like think of how many technologies in world you have where you can almost do anything. And programming is one of those few things. It's like mathematics, right? It's universal. It's applicable everywhere. You're only bounded by your by your imagination, and that to me, you know, continues to be sort of, you know, like what's really special about programming.
Tell us briefly about the techie journey. You started with BASIC. What else did you stumble upon? Where did that take you?
I started with BASIC, taught myself C along the way, and I was just shocked at how much faster, C would be compared to BASIC. It was just mind-blowing. But it would also take a lot more time to write the same program, as I learned. And Julia, in some sense, you know, it solves that, you know, like having the ease of use and the performance in the same package, like, you know, it goes back all the way, right, to every programmer's journey. Over time, I've had the opportunity of having several mentors who have been influential. Back when I was in engineering college in Mumbai, I ran into these two economists, Ajesha and Susan Thomas, and I did a lot of work on parallel computing with them, and that's kind of, you know, what got me excited into more of the scientific and parallel computing kinds of applications. Went from a PhD then to UC Santa Barbara, and my advisor, John Gilbert, was one of the, you know, he was very deeply sort of part of the MATLAB ecosystem. And he, you know, so he's a tremendous mentor and guide for me. And I learned MATLAB from him. And my thesis was about building a parallel, you know, MATLAB-like language at that point. And so sort of through that journey, it was always, you know, one of the applications in my thesis using all the technology I built was this software that would predict wildlife corridors, right? So it was very interesting. I mean, and it's a whole topic by itself, but I built one of the, you know, the software that we built was very widely used since then to map out, you know, hey, what parcels of land should I buy to connect different national parks, you know, those corridors, so that animals can kind of move across these landscapes, because of the conflict with urbanization and land use and all that. And it turned out to be a computationally very challenging problem, and we came up with a very innovative solution. So I was always sort of excited about scientific applications and scientific software. That was what I did for my PhD. And then after my PhD, I, you know, connected up with my co-founders, it's what sort of, you know, it's these one-off experiences that I had sort of over the years kind of all came together in like, hey, why don't we build a programming language that makes all of these things easier and faster, and like, and that message resonated with a lot of people, and that's how, you know, Julia came about. And then, you know, some of the first early contributors and users came along. And this is the part that is rare, right? Because, you know, of course, not many people can build programming languages, but of the people who build programming languages, very few actually make it out and are impactful in the real world. Because, you know, it's one thing to sort of build something interesting and cute and that explores new ideas. And it's a different thing for the world to then come in and say, hey, this is actually interesting, and it changes the way I'm thinking about things or doing things, and it, you know, it's a tremendous value over what came before, and that is sort of been the best part of the journey with Julia, right? That building a programming language that is adopted by the world is tremendous.
You're also CEO of Julia Hub, the company. Did it come naturally to you, the transition from pure scientist to entrepreneur, or were there things you had to unlearn and learn quickly?
I would say that it is not unlearning as much as just learning new things, like, and new domains, right? Like, you know, we started out as scientists, and, you know, all of us, you know, were entrepreneurs the moment we started a company. And then you kind of learn about business and customers and sales and marketing and sort of all the different aspects of building a business. And then as the company grows, you know, from 10 people to, you know, 50 people, to, we are now about 100 people across the world. A fully distributed company. We have an office, you know, we are here in Bangalore, and we have an office in Boston as well. But otherwise, almost, I would say, more than half the company is actually remote. And, you know, this is, you just sort of have to learn how to build an organization and how to work with, you know, diverse sets of people who are not all technical in nature. And like building a successful business, you know, having a successful technology does not necessarily mean you'll build a successful business, right? And there's been a lot of learning along the way, and we've been tremendously, you know, it's been tremendous. We've received tremendous help from our investors, in fact, and our board members, who have, you know, patiently sort of helped us learn some of these things. So for example, Bob Muglia is you know, one of our board members who was the CEO of Snowflake. He built Snowflake, and you know, he was the president of Microsoft before, and you know, he's helped us think through, you know, hey, how do you not only build successful programming language communities, but also, you know, a meaningful business model around those? And we recently have David Joyce, who joined our board, who is a Boeing board member and was the CEO of GE Aviation. He built a lot of the jet engines that we fly on, right? And he's been tremendously helpful in terms of thinking about industrial companies and you know, how do we build programming tools for the physical world? Okay. So it's been a journey, and it's been a lot of learning, and I've enjoyed every bit of it. Like I do not feel that I have given up technology to do business full time. Like I keep, you know, If you go onto my GitHub profile, you'll still see that there are contributions coming into Julia from me, but of course not at the pace that I used to 10 years ago, maybe.
Okay, one kind of standard question that I like to ask any expert in any field. If you look at the way tech is developing in general, whether it's software or, like you said, even industrial tech, IoTs, drones and sensors and things that we can't see but that we know are out there.
Yep.
And they can be out there for good, but they can also be out there for bad surveillance, yep, and invasion and whatnot. So overall, if you look at the way tech is developing today in the world and the pace at which it's changing, what worries you, what keeps you up at night, and what are some of the things that you're more optimistic about?
So, this is not just new with software or modern, when we use the word tech, we are often referring to software related technologies, right? But go back all the way, think about fire. It provided heat and warmth and allowed us to, cook our food and ingest calories and, evolve as human beings, and was a weapon at the same time, right? And so every technology that has ever come about in history has been dual use. And that's the same with, nuclear or space or software. And cybersecurity, being a big part of the software weaponization today, right? So I personally just consider it as a given that any tool will be used for both good or bad, and it is up to us to sort of focus on. To me, what gives me optimism is that modern democracies, right? Like India, one of the world's largest democracies, right? Or like the United States or some of the European countries, right? A lot of these places have democratic guardrails that kind of keep, technology in service for the good of society. And it's up to us as voters or as participants in these democratic processes to ensure that, we regulate lightly but meaningfully, and channel technology for useful purposes that actually help us all, as opposed to destructive uses. But they'll always exist, and look at us, right? Like at India, we have to and this maybe goes back to my work on Aadhaar, right? Like, not only do we need to uplift our country and our economy and meet the aspirations of 1 billion people, but at the same time, we also need to maintain a strong, modern armed forces and a military, right? And the same technologies in both domains need to exist, and you just have to embrace the good and the bad and kind of make sure that you have good decision making and good politicians and good policies and an engaged population, which will finally be an educated population. That's your best hope.
I suppose the biggest difference that seems to be emerging now, based on what the Aam Aadmi or the layperson can figure out, based on what the experts are saying, is that for the first time there is the fear that the tech can develop a mind of its own. And sometimes when there's also, when there is a media frenzy, can also get this fear that tech getting the mind of its a mind of its own is almost imminent. Again, I won't put you in the spot by asking you to take a side, but I'm curious about how you would think about this if you wore your scientist's hat, how you'd approach it if you wore your entrepreneur's cap.
I think whether it becomes sentient or has the mind of its own is a very subjective question, and I think it's I think that's a very sort of complex debate, and let's look at the things that are absolutely true and facts, right? That some of these technologies have matured in ways that we could not imagine and faster than we've imagined, right? And they will continue doing that, whether they become, whether they develop a mind of their own is actually immaterial in some sense. It's the capabilities that there are being developed along the way and the impact that they're having on our economy is already a tremendous change in society, right? And I think that is just going to kind of keep on happening and there's no stopping.
Yeah, that's both exciting and scary, I would say.
But, that's what happened, I like to think of the steam engine, right? I think it was the queen back then who was asked about what her thoughts were about the steam engine. She was like, this is going to sort of, put a lot of people out of jobs if machines can do the work that people used to do. And we've had this question come up over and over and over again. And there is a group of people who now believe that, oh, maybe AI has is making so many changes so fast that we don't have time to adjust. But I think we said those same things, in the past as well. And I think human beings are much more complex and much more innovative and creative. And, yes, there will be new tools and there will be upheavals and reorganization of society. And we'll have to learn to cope with it. But I'm not pessimistic maybe that's the crux of your question here, right? That I'm not pessimistic, I'm actually optimistic.
Excellent. Dr. Viral Shah, thank you so much for your time. And you made time for me very generously on a work day. Definitely hope to keep the conversation going. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks, Hari.
That's it for this conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back soon with another episode of Startup Fridays. And until then, have a great Friday and a wonderful weekend. I'm Hari Arakli. Thank you for listening.